this conference to chat. I'm very pleased to introduce to you a very distinguished panel today. Martin Kretschmer is, as you all know, the director of this wonderful resource and network that is CREATE, and he is talking about empirical effects of term extension, which is part of his interest, as we have seen today. Then next we will have Sean Hargreaves-Hee, who is a professor of political economy at King's College, London. And he researches on social influences on individual decision making, and also the regulation of media pluralism, on which he's talking today.
Okay, so my talk is a bit different than most of them that happened up to now, because this is really a research design talk. We are at the early stages, and I thought I'd make use of the expertise in the room to help us, because it's a typical kind of data problem which occurs in many empirical studies. And it's unfortunately again on the music industry, but it helps me that we've got the right expertise about the data sources in the room. So it's part of a larger project. I'm trying to persuade economists to take copyright seriously, and as part of this effort, we recruit economists, we also try to persuade them that they should devote time to it. And the larger ambition is to work out econometrically what the effects are of being in and out of copyright. It could be in scope, it could be in length. There are different dimensions to it. And there have been obviously a number of studies on this, but not many. And it really goes to the heart of what copyright is all about. If you don't understand what difference it makes, whether you're in or out, then it's very hard to design any policy. So it's really really at the fundamental level of what copyright is all about. And the site we're choosing for our pilot is the term extension for sound recordings, which is very recent. So we had the term extension in the directive 2011. 77 EU, and it came into force in 2013, and for a good reason. So the reason is that the 1963 recordings wouldn't fall into the public domain. They're clearly very valuable, we'll come to this. And so they had to implement it before the end of 2013. So the implementation date here is 1st November. And that means that the 1963 recordings remain protected for another 20 years. Term extension initially was planned to be 95 years, from 50 to 95, to match the US doctrine, the Sony Bono Term Extension Act, for works for hire extended to 95 years. As you know, most of you at least know that with any music file, with any music record, there are numerous rights involved, but the two most important ones are the publishing rights, basically the rights in the notes, and then the rights in the performance. What we're talking about here at the moment is just the rights in the performance, which are typically held by the producer. Under UK law, the producer is the person who makes the arrangements for the recording, and that's interpreted in financial terms, so who puts the money on the table normally owns the record. Okay, so for the underlying copyright, the right in the notes, nothing has changed from term extension in sound recordings. So that is still alive plus 70 years, but in effect it's available under compulsory license. It's not a compulsory license in law, but in practice. You know, you just pay your 8.5% of the mechanical royalty to the collecting society, and then you can re-release, you can make a cover version of a record, or if it's out of the sound recording, out of term, you can just re-release it in a different version. You could enhance it digitally, and you pay your royalties to the publisher, and who passes on some money to the composer. Okay, so by term extension, so in the heated debate prior to 2011, it went on for probably, well, I assume since 1998, really, since the term extension in the US, the car around moved on. I mean, that's how the the politics work. So there were several attempts, to extend it in the UK alone, and Gowers Review recommended against it, and the caravan moved to Europe, and in several permutations, eventually it arrived in a directive. And the four arguments made in favor of term extension are those which I list here. The first one is, it's good for artists. Artists will earn more if the term is longer. The second one is that more and more diverse works will be produced. This is really quite puzzling. The argument would be there would be more money available for investment. So if there will be more revenues coming in, if there are more exclusive rights for a period of time, and therefore it's more money for investment. That's one argument. Another argument is that if there's a right owner still having an interest in a recording, then they would re-release it or look after it better than if it falls in the public domain. So these are the two arguments which would suggest, suggested in this context that more stuff will be produced. The third one is basically just a negative argument. It says, there's no harm done. Nobody pays for it, really. And the fourth one is competitive advantage between countries. So if the US has a longer term, then countries which have shorter term are in a worse position. But it really may, intuitively, it's probably the other way around. But again, we've got four arguments here which basically pulled and persuaded parliamentarians and ministers to swing one way. The most important one is the one related to artists' earnings, and this is a typical quote. I could have given you hundreds of those. I'm not talking about featured artists like Cliff Richard or Charles Aznavour. I'm talking about the thousands of anonymous session musicians who contributed to sound recordings in the late 50s and 60s. They will no longer get airplay royalties from their recordings, but these royalties are often their sole pension. So it's really, it is, session musicians who appeared in 1960 recordings who are now starving, and this change in law will help them. And so we make this big decision on really quite an important body of cultural work, for a really quite a small effect. So there are several interesting aspects. Apart from the economic study of ins and out of copyright, there within the term directive, there are three legal innovations which are very interesting in its own right as legal innovations. They may be applied even in other settings, even before the term is up. And in some ways, that could be best viewed as a direct regulation of creator contracts by law. They are not framed like that, but that's their effect. So the first one is basically the sessions fund. They're quite tricky legal provisions, but it's worthwhile spending a minute on those. A non-featured performer is one who has transferred their performance rights to the producer of the sound recording in return for single payments. So they don't turn up on the cover, they're not credited, they don't get any royalty payments. They had one, here's your 20 quid, that's it, you've done your performance. After 50 years following the publication of a recording, a non-featured performer is entitled to receive an annual share of a sum equal to 20% of gross revenues from the physical and online sales made of their recordings in the previous year. Okay? So the unnamed session musicians from the early 60s is entitled to receive 20% of the gross revenues, so you can't really reduce that amount by accounting techniques. It's the money that comes in, both from physical and online sales. So the way that's implemented is there will be a kind of a session fund to which the record companies have to pay some money in. The session fund is held by a collecting society, and the collecting society pays it out to performers, but the performers have to claim, so they have to register with them. Then the second legal... Yeah.
So is that if there are six of them, they get 120%?
No, I think they basically the record companies have to give 20% of gross revenues from the last year from the, but only for the extended term recordings. Basically, only assume the 63, then next year will be 64, and so on. Only from the extended term recordings, and that goes into that lump sum. And if more people surface to claim it, then it will be sliced thinner. Second provision, in some ways, is probably the most interesting one, is the use it and lose it provision. which I've argued in other papers may well be an approach which could be approached used in generally in, relating to copyright and also other intellectual property rights where there's surfaces already. So if 50 years after its publication, the producer of a sound recording is not making the recording available for sale, both physically and online, in sufficient quantity, okay, in sufficient quantity is quite a tricky phrase, a performer who has assigned his or her rights in the recording to the producer may give written notice to the producer that he or she wishes to reclaim their performer's rights in the recording. Then after you give this notice, if after a further year that the producer has not made the recording available for sale, then the performer's rights revert to the performer and the producer's copyright expires. Okay? So it's a, so in practical terms, you know, basically you feature on a, this is now aimed not at the non-featured one, it's at the featured performers. So the featured performers who performed in a, let's say, 1963 recording, which now benefited from the extended term, they can file a notice to their record company if their record is not available, both physically and online. And then they have to wait for a year, and then if the record is still not available, then they could reclaim it and re-release it under their own terms. They could resell it. It's up to them. Freedom of contract. Third provision, clean slate provision. This is to address the issue that a lot of the early recording contracts operate with an advance, which is now recouped. So there were lots of tricks in the trade, like breakage of vinyls, that type of thing. So lots of deductions being made before you know you paid back your advance, and only once you've had your recouped your advance, then you would get royalties from the sales of as it is in your contract. So basically, that provision just says, you know, we disregard all that. So the contractual provisions relating to advancements and recoupment are just disregarded. And we start again. Okay, so there, I think, all three interesting legal provisions. Our prediction probably is that they will not have much empiric effect at all because they're very complicated and, you know, they address a very small and, well, I would be interested to hear what you think, but whether it's even worth going, investing lots of resources, studying this empirically, but it may be for policy reasons. Even if you find it's not working, it may be interesting to do. Okay, so the main thrust of the talk really is to look at methodologies for solving the ecometric end. And, okay, there are two. One is the change in performance earnings, which will be probably very difficult to find any data on. It actually reacts before you touch it. It's interesting. It's electric current coming from my hand. The supply type of data. So is the stuff available? What are the sales data, streams data, and how is it priced? And the way to think about it is, obviously, we've got now some records. I mean, that in basically the same family, the same body of cultural products, which is quite nice. You know, okay, there should be not a huge difference between 1962 and 1963. And the only difference, really, in that is that they have a different legal status. And that's a kind of, you know, natural experiment. It's an interesting kind of setting in. It's because it affects a whole body of works in the same way. So the current plan, it's just a plan, but is to create a sample of releases from 61 and 62, which are now out of copyright, and 63 and 64, which will not be out of copyright for the next 20 years, and then track what happens to those as they cross the term threshold. So we need, therefore, two data sources. We need the one which creates the original sample, which we then track, and then we need a temp-dependent variable. We have to find some data about what happens to those records in the market now. And so data sources is actually not as easy as one thinks. We think it's very easy to find out which songs and which albums have been released in 61, 62, 63, 64. It's actually not that easy. There's no authoritative source. And the best one probably is the most comprehensive one is probably the record retailer that has not been digitized. It's in hard copy, and somebody would have to go to the newspaper archive of the British Library and read through, you know, all releases of that year. It's possible. It's possible to do. The other route, which is the one I think we very likely to adopt, is to use a user-generated site, Discogs, which looks like that, which is basically done by lovers of music who catalogue all records released from 1950s till now. And they catalogue them by genre, by you can filter it by country. And the interesting aspect from our, you know, that's one of the questions I have for you, is using a user-generated site suggests that there's somebody there who values the record in some ways, okay? And in some, and we are really not interested, from a policy perspective, stuff which nobody wants to use, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it's copyright or not. Where we should be interested in is if somebody wants to use it, if there's somebody sees value in it. Therefore, I think we could justifiably maybe obviously have to spot check against probably a few releases where the gaps here are. And the numbers are also pretty possible. So we've been assured by Kisses that we can scrape that site easily. There's an API available. We can, you know, so the starting point is probably quite promising. And you can also filter them by, they've got a number of categories here. So for example, you can have the one which are sold at the highest prices as originals, and you can also there any number of filters you can apply which the users generated, which again may give us a nice way into it. So 1962 is now out of copyright in the UK. It includes Love Me Do, and it includes Miles Davis Blue, it includes some early Dylan, so there's some valuable stuff in there, really. So we would expect, you know, if the market doesn't pick that difference up, maybe copyright doesn't matter at all. Who knows? We did an initial assessment with musicologist, popular music specialist John Williamson in the music department in Glasgow, and says that 62 and 63 show broadly similar characteristics. It's still a very single-dominated market. The albums just start to appear, and as the main kind of sales currency, they only take off in 1964. And there are a few examples of for the aficionados, maybe John will appreciate those little stories. Mrs. Mills and. And probably a talk of this type should have examples, oral examples as well. So I feel reasonably confident that we can do something with the Discogs data. I feel less confident that we have found a good source of data for what's happening in the market now. And an additional complication is that we have obviously, during the last few years, a major technological change from sales to streaming. And for streaming, if your Spotify subscription is $9.99 in the UK, so that price doesn't change whether they're in or out of copyright records in there. Though the royalty streams from Spotify will change, whether it's in copyright or not, that will matter to Spotify. So there may be still something I can do with Spotify data, but. Firstly, we haven't got it yet, despite having a way into the page, and I'm not confident we will get it. Secondly, the Nielsen's data, which is the kind of gold standard used in the entertainment industry, is unaffordable. I think at this point, Joel was quiet as well in his talk, but we're talking in excess of $500,000. For the sales data and internet use, so tricky, and collecting societies difficult. They won't give you that stuff either because they probably don't want to know. I mean, I don't say more there either. So So what data do we use? Maybe we have to use again something which we can scrape. So you know, use something where internet data can be used. The Google Trends have been used successfully by a number of econometric studies. So they track searches for particular terms. You would have to make the assumption that something which is searched more is also used more, but you could at least try that. Similarly, with Wikipedia traffic, you know, they give you the data of visits. So if you track, about 3,000 songs is a bit hard, but you could, in theory, see, you know, which of those have a Wikipedia page and what is the traffic to them, and is there any change over time when as they pass over the threshold. But it's a real puzzle. But it should be possible. It seems to me. It's quite clearly that there's very valuable, culturally and economically valuable material which has passed in the public domain. You would expect that that effect shows somewhere up in data we can capture. But that's a research design problem. Okay, so we hope after we've done a bit of piloting with Foundry colleagues that we also do similar work with books. I mean, Paul Heald has done some work on this, which is not a bad model, starting with best-selling lists from the. But again, the US has a particular copyright framework where anything before 1923 is out of copyright, so you've got, a nice kind of threshold there in the market. It's much harder to, if you, every you have to calculate for each piece of work when it expires, for the Great Gatsby. Scott Fitzgerald died in 1940, so that's out in Europe in 2010, and you get, anecdotally, you get a lot of adaptations. You've got the Westminster musical, you've got ballets, you've got kind of things which would have to be paid before expiration. So quite clearly something happening there as well, but it's probably very hard to create a data set, but who knows. And we also thought where we should also look at other type of interventions, for example, in fine art, where we've got the artist resale rights, which has been changed recently in Europe. That is not really an exclusive right, but a right to remuneration. But again, I think it would be interesting for copyright policy to see if you change the right to remuneration, does that really have an effect? And it's similar in some ways to the sideline of our sound recordings. So we're looking really to very quite ambitiously to assemble data which are suitable for econometric analysis. So the still on the term extension for sound recordings, we think I think it's worthwhile supplementing this larger data sets with some insights into what happened to certain key recordings over the period. So what are the release patterns as over those 50 years since 1962? And I think there may be an interesting story to be told which one could set against the larger data. And I think the King story here, that's again one from John Williamson, is an interesting one, I think, for cultural and economic reasons. So the Kings, had no further involvement with the label, and it was then sold several times. So they had no control at all what happened with their records over time. So they were whether they benefited financially, we don't quite know. What happens if back catalogs are sold? But it's also interesting to that they had no influence over the quality of the reissues. There are probably a more right dimension to this, which is also interesting. Okay, so it's a more kind of shadowy picture that may emerge here, but it's probably useful to have at least some of that against the quantitative work. And then this is the study which will look at the implementation of the three new provisions in the UK. I don't think we can do any quantitative work on that at all. we may be able to get from PPL, from collecting society records over time, you know, how much these 20% actually are. We may be able to work out what the sales for particular records are from, because the session fund depends on gross revenues. So there may be something which can be done, but more likely, again, will be qualitative work, really trying to work really out, you know, who has claimed for something, how did they hear about that they, you know, may have featured, what was the evidence that they featured. You know, anybody can say, I've played on the 1964 record, but who is going to support that you're entitled to this? You know, I played the second saxophone. Don't you remember? Okay. So there may be something interesting to be done there. Okay. So what I really would be very keen on, and I think Theo would be also very keen on, is to hear what we do with data which tells us something about availability, price. Thank you. The Nielsen data.
Why is that exactly that expensive? $500,000.
Joel, do you want to help us a bit?
Make it 1 million.
Can I ask a related question on that?
Yeah.
Which is, why aren't academics asking for some kind of academic licensing in the same way that you've had for millions of years, or at least a lot of books, in relation to commercially available data? This must be affecting everybody in so many ways. You have publishers who are making data available, they're pricing academics out of it. If that was in book form, you'd just get it, and it would be in libraries in London and Oxford. So why aren't you arguing for something similar to a price of data?
Nielsen does have an academic price for $6,000 or $10,000 access to their book or music database, but that you get one product at a time access. So it's effectively not very useful. Although it might work for you. For $6,000 or $10,000, then you could just pay somebody to query 1,000 1963 and 1,000 1964 products.
I think that's doable. I think that's doable. Yeah. But the price, the commercial price, I mean, it's very clear that they've been a proposition as the prime supplier of authoritative information on you know, sales, entertainment products, mainly music and books. And they also have, I don't know the methodology for online use, but they have a very sophisticated capture of internet traffic as well. And it's obviously, you know, they're protecting, I assume, their commercial position. But it's also, I think, where you're right is, you know, this goes to the heart of copyright law. We need to understand whether copyright law matters or not, and in which respects it matters. And really, the only way to do it is if you have some of that data. You need to have reliable data on consumption. You need to have reliable data on supply. Yeah, somehow.
So copyright matters because you can't get hold of the data to prove that it does. Mm. Or doesn't.
Yeah.
That's good.
So, yeah, mainly, I think the $6,000 or $8,000 solution is a glimmer of hope, I think.
But how about scraping? Just so one of the questions is which products are available, you say.
Yeah.
And that in some sense is not even in Nielsen, because a product's not available unless it sells.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so that's maybe not a problem, but maybe it is a problem for low demand products.
Yeah.
A huge spike at one sale. What about just scraping Amazon?
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to query, you know, Aretha Franklin, whatever, and then see how many different albums are there.
Mm.
With the same name, how many different providers are there of the same album?
Yeah.
What IMCA does in her paper.
Yeah, I think that you should certainly availability at different versions. You should be able to get that way. And Amazon can be scraped. So I think that is, yeah.
Well, there are other things.
But not songs. I mean, that's a problem, isn't it? Sorry. It's albums, which may be a problem with that. Sorry.
The there's a lot of information on Wikipedia, which I'm sure you've heard of. You can look things up. And then there's a thing called All Music. Have you used that? You can look at All Music, and that will tell you some of these things. But of course, I don't know whether it covers the sort of area.
But in some ways, I would like to use user-generated data because it shows that people want to use it. And I think you don't know whether, you know, what you feel, Joel, is that justifiable?
I think certainly. Because you can use your Discogs or Music Brains, either one or both. All Music is much more, it's curated and much, there's much less in, much fewer artists, but much more information.
Hmm.
And I'd like to ask about more the origins of the directive.
Yeah.
You put the reasons for bringing it forward very bluntly. For instance, consumers will not have to pay more. Well, that's not the case, clearly.
We may find out. Yeah.
Well, but if it was in the public domain, then you wouldn't pay. So I would have 20 years of free music extra. That didn't. Anyway, so. Yeah, so those were the arguments for, and what were the arguments against, and who put them forward?
I don't want to say too much about it, but I was part of an academic group where we tried to master the what we know about it. I mean, empirical data is not very strong, but some of the points you make have been made forcefully. I think that the way it was orchestrated is that they found a number of artists who didn't write their own music and therefore did receive a lot of royalties from performing. So Cliff Richard would be an obvious one, Nana Mouskouri. They spread them around European countries to get the right kind of people who had quite a big fan base, and they used them to front the argument. And when that didn't quite wasn't quite enough, then they invented the poor session musicians. But it was organized, it was organized by IFPI. I mean, we know that. I mean, if there's evidence on this, that they staffed the office in Brussels, which organized these. And then it was just normal lobbying.
It was mega lobbying that I know.
Yeah.
Chartley Commissioner was got at by someone who we really admired as a musician, and the same happened at number 10, and the call from everyone's hero, Cliff Richard, really raised the Prime Minister give me the knees, and there was this sort of real play into the personal vanity of very, very senior people that produces, it wasn't as though officials thought it was a good idea, we didn't, but it produces the absolute unanswerable, which is, I want you to do this, and I know I'm right. I get elected, and I'm in touch with the people who care about this. It was nice to think that serious things got as much attention.
Jim again?
Yeah, I was just going to say, on the other side, there's also the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Open Rights Group, and we organized a petition. There's a website called soundcopyright.eu, and we made the argument that this was pointless, it wasn't going to help, it was going to reduce cultural diversity, it was going to prevent people from accessing culture, there was going to be a nightmare for libraries and academics, that the evidence, such as it was from IVIA and other people, was very clear that all the money would flow to the big corporations and nobody else. Where this appears to have got some traction actually was in parts of Eastern Europe, because I think some people kind of worked out that they were basically signing a deal to give money to America for no particular reason, because all their cultural goods are mostly American, so the royalties are just going to flow straight out of their shops to the USA for no particular reason other than they voted this. So stuck for several years with smaller nations kind of saying, well, why do we want to do this? What's in it for us? And they got peeled off, presumably by kind of sideways deals. If you sign this, maybe we'll do that.
No, there's a political science project in there, but as academics, we could also say, be grateful it has happened because we've got this now natural experiment. No, but I think it's a tricky one. I think we try not to, in setting this up, we really have to be very careful that we don't hold a view. If it turns out, and it may turn out on Spotify, term extension didn't really make any difference at all, what will tell us to on this story? I mean, that's an interesting question as well.
Yeah.
So does that mean that technology has basically overtaken the statutory arrangements? That's an interesting question.
Sorry, Martin, because it would mean that a politician's hunch was always worth backing over the evidence. That it would be very interesting to learn. Those of us who were saying no, really, this is terribly clever, were wrong, and you should always learn from being wrong. But I would regret it in terms of nasty and fashioned lobbying and celebrity glamour overtaking a bit of rational analysis.
Can I just ask how big is the market of 50 to 70 years?
Well, we have got some data on that.
That of music, because it's just a question about how big are the stakes.
They are huge. They're huge. Okay, so share of 2004 UK records by sales by copyright date. From the 2000s, so the last 4 years is 6% of all sales. And then from the 1990s, it's 12%. 1970s is still 10%, 1960s is 5%. So it's about 7 million actual annual sales. That was in 2004, of 7 million UK records from the 1960s were sold in 2004. So from that, I assume it's in GDP terms, it will not tip the economy over, but it's clearly, since they're mostly in the hand of four corporations, those. That makes a big difference to their balance sheet.
That was the whole 60s?
But the
so including the good stuff.
That includes the good stuff, yeah. Yeah, so the 5% is the 7 million are the whole 60s.
That is not going to be what there is going to be in 1963 and 1964, because that would be a much smaller
amount
section,
of that. Sure,
of course.
Yeah.
So we need to wrap up here.